Hello, welcome back to Slightly Fox, and this month we venture into unsettling territory with Angela Carter of Bloody Chamber fame and a wider exploration of magical realism. Joining the podcast today, we have Slightly Fox editor Gail Perkis. Hi, Gail.
Hi.
And fellow foxes Anna Kerr.
Hello.
And Stephanie Allen.
Hello.
My name's Philippa Lamb. Hi, everyone. What news?
So I'm thinking about the autumn issue. We usually have between 16 and 17 articles in each one, and I've got quite a choice, and it's a sort of constant juggling act doing this, but we've got a lovely piece on Chaucer's Knight's Tale, something on Josephine Tay's Inspector Grant crime fiction novels.
Oh, I love those books.
Stephen Crane, The Red Badge of Courage, William Golding's The Spire, and then on non-fiction, a glorious book on cheese. Something on the Elephant Man, which is written by a doctor at the London Hospital, a serial killer, and an American war diary.
Sounds fantastic. The cheese essay particularly.
Yes, it's a great book. It's called Cheddar Gorge, which is a nice a nice title.
And Steph, I think you're looking ahead to Reader's Day, aren't you?
Yes, we're starting to anticipate events again.
Just remind people about what that is.
Well, Reader's Day is our one-day literary festival. 5 or 6 talks, cakes, and you meet all the staff. There's a fantastic bookshop there. And we hold it at the Art Workers Guild in Bloomsbury. It's a really lovely day. Hopefully, we will be having it this year on the 6th of November. So all fingers crossed, nothing changes.
Well, I can vouch for the quality of the cakes and indeed the speakers. Yeah, any ideas on the lineup?
Yes, we had Michael Palin booked last year. Hopefully he might be able to make it this year. And we usually have a couple of biographers and the winner of the Slightly Foxed Best First Biography Award speaking as well.
Sounds good, Steph. Yeah, it would be great to be back at that event again. It was absolutely spectacular. The year before last was the one I went to. I think the first one I ever went to, and it was really, really great. So on to this month's guest, and that's Edmund Gordon, award-winning writer and critic, senior lecturer in creative writing at King's College London. His first book, a biography of Angela Carter, was published in 2016 and, among many plaudits, won that Slightly Foxed First Biography Prize that Steph was talking about. Welcome to the podcast, Edmund.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Now, for people, I mean, I think a lot of people know Angela Carter's name. Not everyone will have read her work. Can you give us a little potted biography? Who was she and how would you characterise her as a writer?
Well, as a writer, she was a very unusual writer, certainly for an English author, in that she was funny and wild in her imagination and did different things with each book and was much more interested in kind of imaginative exuberance and linguistic texture than she was in sort of social and psychological detail. And she went through various different phases in her writing career. Biographically, I'll try to give you a potted biography. It's 5 years now since I finished my book and I'm always a bit anxious when I come to talk about it,
I'll have forgotten everything.
Yeah, well, I actually have. So if I go quiet, it means I'm searching the index. She was born in 1940 in Eastbourne because that's where her brother had been evacuated during the war. And her mother and father followed him down there as soon as they heard from him. But shortly afterwards moved back to the South London district of Balham, which is where she grew up. And she grew up in a sort of middle-class family. Her father was a journalist. He was the night editor of the Press Association. And it was a very kind of intense domestic atmosphere, I think is probably the best way of describing it.
In what way?
Her father was a very eccentric man, and her mother was a very eccentric woman, and they were both rather overprotective of Angela. There was a 10-year age gap between Angela and her older brother, which meant that she was, to all intents and purposes, an only child, and her parents were in their 40s by the time she was born, and they were obsessively anxious about her and indulged her with treats, both kind of toys and chocolates and ice creams and all the rest of it, which is a bigger thing than it might sound these days, because of course rationing was in place then and these things were quite hard to get hold of, but somehow they did. But her mother was incredibly nervous around her and would rub so much Zambuk ointment onto her chest that her top was permanently stained green and would always place a handkerchief behind her head when she sat down in public places.
Wow. She sounds quite like a young Queen Victoria.
I think so. I mean, quite a strange environment to grow up in. And really, Angela, when she was in her teens, quite consciously realised that she had to put some distance between herself and this very interfering, overprotective mother, and sort of forged a personality which really was in opposition to all of her mother's values. So her mother was politically quite left-wing, but socially very, very conservative. So her mother, she didn't just support the Labour Party, she went so far as to support the Russians when they sent tanks into Hungary in 1956, and yet would change the channel if a TV presenter or an actor had been divorced, because she considered that so utterly beyond the pale.
So Angela pushes back on this.
Pushes back on this and effectively forges a personality which is diametrically opposed to that. And, you know, she began smoking, which her mother was horrified by, and vigorously swearing. And she took to dressing like a beatnik and refused to go to university, which her parents were very keen for her to do. She was a clever girl and her teachers had suggested she might get into Oxford. And her mother said, "That's wonderful. We'll buy a flat in the city so that we can remain close to you."
Wow. Yeah,
that's anyone who's ever been a teenager.
What year is this, Edmund? When are you talking about exactly?
She left school in 1958.
Yeah.
And instead of going to university, became a journalist on a local newspaper, the Croydon Advertiser. And also, with all these edible treats that her mother gave her, Angela had become really very overweight by the time she was in her mid-teens. And by her own account, was about 15 stone. Part of her pushing back against her mother was to go on a rigorous diet and lose a lot of weight, which seems to have tipped over into anorexia around the time that she left home and began working on the Croydon Advertiser.
I mean, she's obviously, as you say, she has a very controlling mother and she's trying to take back control in all sorts of areas of her life. Mm. So she goes into journalism like her father. When did she first venture into writing fiction?
At that time, so she wrote two novels while she was working at the Croydon Advertiser, neither of which were published and neither of which have survived. But they seem to have been written very much in the shadow of D.H. Lawrence, who was her favourite author at the time.
And very fashionable at the time, yeah.
And very fashionable at the time, because it's shortly after the end of the Chatterley ban. And kind of sexy, I think that's the point. He seemed to be doing something a bit outrageous, a bit rebellious, a bit different. She met at this time a man called Paul Carter, who became her husband. He was an industrial chemist, and she moved to Bristol with him. And it was really there that she began writing the fiction that has survived. Her first novel, Shadow Dance, which is a kind of gothic murder story set in a very Bristol-like city, appeared in 1966, and she published one novel a year for the rest of that decade.
And how did they go?
They went very well. I mean, they were received very positively for a first-time writer. They got, on the whole, very positive reviews. They won some prizes such as the Somerset Maugham Award and the John Llewellyn Rees Prize. She was kind of an up-and-coming young novelist. Things were improving for her, but meanwhile her marriage was deteriorating quite significantly. Her husband suffered from depression and they basically would go days on end without exchanging a word. And so when she received the Somerset Maugham Award, the rules of that award are that the money has to be spent on foreign travel. So Angela used it to leave her husband and went to Japan with it. And in Japan, this is really, for the first time, she'd sort of shrugged off all of these stifling circumstances that she'd been living through. And that, this is when this great imaginative flowering really happens. And she began living with a Japanese man and wrote her books, The Infernal Design Machines of Dr. Hoffman, which was published in 1972, and the short story collection Fireworks, which was published in 1974. The reason that we're still talking about Angela Carter in 2021 is because of the books that she began writing in that period.
So tell me, how did you first come to be interested in her work?
Well, I'm a lot younger than she was, and so she'd already had a sort of canonical status, and I was aware of her when I was at university, but didn't read her at that time because I think her reputation was of quite a sort of kind of hectoring ideologue, and I just found it quite off-putting and didn't
really... A bit strident, yeah.
And also somebody who was interesting for their ideas rather than for the texture of their prose, the stories that they told, etc. Certainly, the idea that she was an incredibly witty writer didn't occur to me at this stage. After I finished my undergraduate degree, I did a short writing course at the Arvon Foundation, which was taught by Ali Smith, and I was very sort of gauche and naive and basically didn't speak for the entire week of the course. And on the last night, I plucked up the courage to say to Ali Smith, "Who's your favourite writer?" And she said Angela Carter. And so I thought, well, if Ali Smith likes her, she must have a bit more going on for her, and I'd better check her out. And I then moved to Berlin, where I came across a secondhand copy of The Magic Toy Shop, Angela Carter's second novel, and was just blown away. It was so far from what I thought that she would be. It was so kind of exuberant and funny and strange and frankly readable that I then tracked down everything else she'd written.
You know, before we get into the detail of some of the other books you've talked about, can we just talk about The Bloody Chamber? Because I think that was published in the late 70s, is that right? And it is the one that most people know of, I think. For anyone who hasn't read it, it talks to all those things you've just talked about her wit and the colour and the elegance of her writing. And it's reimagined fairy tales, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's a series of versions or improvisations on familiar European folk and fairy tales, such as Beauty and the Beast, Bluebeard, Puss in Boots, etc. And really, she wrote it. It was published in 1979. She worked on it between, really, 1976 and 1978 was when most of the stories were written. It came about after she'd been commissioned to translate the fairy tales of Charles Perrault, I'm sorry for my French pronunciation, which is just horrible, I realise, the seminal pioneering 17th century collector of folk and fairy tales. And as part of her research when she was translating that, she read Bruno Bettelheim's book, The Uses of Enchantment, which is a psychoanalytic study of folk tales and fairy tales, which basically argues, to slightly traduce its argument, it argues that fairy tales seek to explain to children and to console children about such terrifying mysteries as sex and death by presenting them in symbolic form. And Angela was very taken with this. I mean, she didn't entirely agree with it. She knew a bit about the historical circumstances in which these stories had initially come about, and she thought it was pretty obvious that in medieval France, where there are woods everywhere, dense woods, that a story which teaches children not to stray off the path doesn't have a purely therapeutic purpose.
Yeah.
And yet, she found the imagery that Bettelheim uncovered within these children's stories, these really violent and sexy images, thrilling from an artistic point of view. So she set about writing this book, in which her aim was basically to allow what she described as the latent content of the stories to rise uncomfortably to the surface. So she kind of exaggerated these images of sex and death to show us what had been hidden within the stories all along.
I mean, Steph, I know you're a huge fan of that book.
Yes, I read a lot of Angela Carter in my late teens and early 20s, and I think she's had an effect on my imagination ever since. Yeah, you mentioned Ali Smith, Edmund. Mm. I just wondered what sort of influence you felt she'd had on female writers since the 70s and 80s. There's a massive proliferation of gothic fantasy now and vampire literature. I was thinking of Anne Rice's series. Do you think her legacy and her influence continues now?
I think it very much does, yes. I mean, I think there have been successive waves of influence that she's had. So there have been writers of sort of Jeanette Winston and Ali Smith's generation, and then among a considerably younger generation, British authors such as Helen Oyeyemi, Kirsty Logan, both of whom write kind of reimagined fairy tales. In America, there are authors, there's Carmen Maria Machado, I think her name is, whose first book, Her Body and Other Parties, the influence of Carter was really pronounced and obvious, and, you know, she's acknowledged it. So I think she's had a huge influence on literature. You know, there's that very obvious line of influence among authors who have played with fairy tale and things. And I think there's a more general influence that she's had in that when she began writing in the 50s and 60s, English fiction was really, I mean, social realism was not just the dominant mode, but the overwhelmingly dominant mode.
Kitchen sink.
Yeah, and I think her sort of openness to pulp genres such as fairy tale, but also such as gothic literature, science fiction, etc., and bringing that into the mainstream of literary fiction. I mean, I think she can really be credited from that point of view with opening the door for writers such as David Mitchell or China Mieville or a vast array of contemporary, you know, many of the contemporary novelists who we regard as the most significant. I mean, Kazuo Ishiguro, who of course won the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago, was a student of Angela Carter's. And, you know, I wonder if he would be so interested in science fiction and the detective story and fantasy as he has been in his last few books without her example.
I mean, I was wondering, as you say, that thing about the colour and the exuberance in the post-war era, that grey era of rationing up to whenever it was, 55. And I mean, there must have been an enormous appetite after all that kitchen sink drama and, as you say, social realism for stuff which was just literally out of this world, lush, colourful, exotic, sexy. You can see how people would have lapped it up.
I think so, yeah. I mean, certainly she felt that it was a very grey landscape. I mean, it's not, you know, there were outliers. Anthony Burgess comes to mind.
Yeah.
But I mean, the sort of really big figures were Kingsley Amis, Alan Sillitoe, etc., who seemed very conventional, all of them by the standards of, you know, most significant literary novelists around these days.
Yeah.
I completely agree with that, all of that on The Bloody Chamber, and I've actually recently gone back to read it, and I actually found it more... I mean, the Bloody Chamber, that tale within the collection, is actually, yeah, it is genuinely quite scary. I don't think that had struck me so much in my first reading of it. I think the language is just so luxurious, and that's what first strikes you. But yeah, I hadn't realised how scary it actually was.
They are scary.
And you can see why she was picked up by television and film as well. And Neil Jordan's film, The Company of Wolves, was a great success, wasn't it? And I should imagine it brought her to the attention of many other readers.
Well, yes. I mean, she had that year. She had the film, and she also had her novel Nights at the Circus came out, which was her most commercially successful book. And of course, she co-wrote the film, the Neil Jordan film, The Company of Wolves, which was based on a couple of the stories. It knits together a couple of the stories about Red Riding Hood with a new narrative framework to hold them together. But yeah, I mean,
I was just going to say, it's worth pointing out that there are some very strong women in the way she retells these stories. Women do extraordinary things, extraordinary and violent things on occasion, and are largely in charge of their own destinies, even if it doesn't look that way in the first place. Would that be a fair assessment, Edward?
I mean, it's certainly a fair assessment. That is absolutely the case. Now, when people said to her, you've written these strong female characters, etc., she tended to play it down and say, I am a woman and that's just how I saw it. That's not what's interesting about the work. I think she was being slightly disingenuous. You know, she was well aware that often in literature we don't see strong women. But she tended to sort of resist, not the description. I think she would have acknowledged that that was an accurate description of the book, but the suggestion that that was sort of why the book was important or interesting.
And that's interesting itself, isn't it? Because, I mean, she was a bit of a feminist icon, but as you say, that wasn't a description she chose to own. Surprising, given the era in which she was writing. It was all about strong women writing and the feminine struggle. But she didn't really want to get into all that, did she?
Well, she didn't... No, she never wanted to get into anything. I mean, she was willfully idiosyncratic, really prized her individuality above anything else. She always described herself as a feminist, but she didn't like ideological purity of any kind. Yeah. And she basically enjoyed winding people up an awful lot. So as soon as anyone started saying, you know, you are a feminist writer, you are a magical realist writer, she would begin disagreeing with them. And she described herself as enjoying sniping from the sidelines. A lot of her work, both fiction and non-fiction, is concerned with sort of unpicking the mythic structures that underwrite our existences, the kind of hand-me-down roles that we all feel forced to inhabit.
Yes.
And some of the most important roles to her were the roles of gender identity. Part of that was her rejection of her mother's kind of dainty brand of femininity, and she was very keen to say, this is not the only way of being a woman. But really...
Yeah, but the tales are very earthy, aren't they? Women in charge of their own sexuality, there's, you know, they're certainly not mimsy in any way that her mother might have approved of.
Absolutely. I mean, her mother accused her of writing dirty books.
She must have been delighted, I should think, when that
one. Well, that's strange. I mean, there was a kind of rather racy cover put on the first edition of The Magic Toy Shop, and she was genuinely worried about what her mother was going to make of it. It had a sort of a man with a tongue coming out of his trousers in a very phallic way.
But her central characters were often extremely innocent, weren't they? I mean, that always struck me in her stories and in her novels, who then became the powerful character, often vanquished.
Yes, they go on a feminist journey, don't they? Shall we move on to the kind of wider field of magical realism? Because, Edmund, you mentioned The Infernal Desire Machines of Dr. Hoffman as her most interesting book. Full disclosure, I haven't read this. So why do you think it's so special?
I think it's the kind of fountainhead of all the interesting books she wrote. So it's the turning point at which she starts becoming a really major writer. I mean, The Bloody Chamber, to me, is probably the most interesting book. If I had to take one of her books to a desert island, it would be that or one of the other collections of stories. I mean, I think partly because of the stylistic richness that we've talked about. At short story length, it's delicious, but it can be a bit overwhelming sometimes at novel length. Like
a bit overly rich, yeah.
But The Infernal Design Machines of Dr. Hoffman, I mean, it's an astonishing book, both on its own terms and in the kind of history of English literature. There was just nothing like it, which absorbed Latin American influences as it did. So she wrote it living on a kind of deserted beach in Japan, a place called Chiba, with this Japanese man who she was living with over the period of sort of 6 weeks. I mean, she wrote it really very quickly. It's a novel the basic premise is that the doctor of the title is a kind of surrealist extraordinaire who has worked out how to make desire manifest with his desire machines. And he wages a guerrilla war on an unnamed South American city, where he bombards the city with strange and disturbing images, such that during a concert, suddenly all of the musicians become peacocks, or the walls of a building become mouths all talking and saying different things, etc. And the hero and narrator is a man called Desiderio, who is immune to this plague of images because he's got such a weak imagination. So he is dispatched on a mission to go and find and kill the doctor. And on his journey, he passes through a kind of shifting dreamscape where, you know, in each chapter, the world he enters, it's as if the lens has been turned slightly and things are completely different. So it's a very fantastical novel, really rich in surreal and magical imagery, and really actively embracing the influence of authors such as Jorge Luis Borges. Again, I'm never sure how to pronounce his name, but I think that's a rough approximation. And Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who became extremely fashionable and influential in the decade following that. In the 1980s and the early 1990s, their influence on literature in the English-speaking world was immense. But in 1974, when Angela Carter wrote The Infernal Design Machines of Dr. Hoffman, I just think, you know, most people had never come across this kind of stuff. And it was really thrilling to some and disturbing to others.
I mean, as you say, that was early. But magical realism as a genre, if you can call it a genre, because of the multiplicity of definitions of what it actually means, reading into it over the last couple of weeks, it's kind of dawned on me just how early that concept was. And there's quite a lot of very interesting stuff from the 20s, isn't there, that you might reasonably describe as magical realism? Would you agree with that?
I feel, I think there's a tendency to use it as a term to describe any book in which anything remotely untoward happens. And I think if you do that, it kind of becomes meaningless. I mean, I would not describe, for example, most of Kafka or of Gogol as magical realist, because strange things happen in their books. Their books don't follow the kind of logic of the realist novel. And yet, to me, if it means anything at all, it means writing influenced by a specific movement within Latin American literature in the 1960s and 70s.
And oh, you think it's all about Latin America, do you?
Well, I think it comes from that. I mean, to me, the most useful way of looking at it, and I realise this isn't everybody's definition, but this is the one that I would cleave to, is that there's a distinction between magical realism, which is kind of literature which attends to the grammar of folk tale, folk story, and sort of surrealism, which is literature which attends to the grammar of dreaming and dreams. And so I would say Kafka and Gogol are much more kind of proto-surrealists, really. I think really the Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Carlos Fuentes, Juan Rulfo, authors like that who in the 1960s and 70s were producing these books in Latin America, which kind of allowed the folk tales and the kind of fringe religions of Latin America to be living presences in the story, and attended them the same level of reality and credence as the more realistic elements. But that is sort of what magical realism means to me.
This idea, the kind of magical elements, they're just bound in amongst the day-to-day stuff. There's no distinguishing between the magical elements and what we might consider normality. It's all just normal within the context of the book. Is that what you're...
Well, that's certainly part of it, although that would apply to Kafka's Metamorphosis or Gogol's The Nose. But I think the point about those is that they have no... There's no connection to, like, folk literature. There's no... It's not supernatural or magical there. It's just something strange which has happened.
I think that's a really interesting definition.
Why this strong Latin American connection?
Well, I think Borges, although Borges is not a magical realist, he had a huge influence on the generation, the first generation of magical realist writers. And they were using his influence to find ways of writing fiction differently, fiction which represented the sort of difference of Latin American reality to European reality. And, you know, the conventions of the realist novel had arisen in a very different kind of world to the one that they were living in. And so Márquez, especially in books such as 100 Years of Solitude, forged this prose in which the folk tales and the strange belief systems that surrounded him and had surrounded him as a child were just presences in the text. And that had a huge influence on the English-speaking literature of the next couple of decades. I mean, authors including Salman Rushdie, Ben Okri, yes. Angela Carter, obviously, Louis de Bernier.
Yeah, his South American, Colombian trilogy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a vast number of writers at that time. I mean, Toni Morrison in Beloved, I think, is imbibing a lot of that tradition. I mean, now it's completely out of fashion, but I think there was a period in the 80s and early 90s when, you know, Booker Prize winners were frequently books in which people started flying suddenly or, you know, wept blood or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm.
So I really, really loved the Louis de Bernier Colombian trilogy when I read it when it came out, whenever that was, 80s, 90s. But what do other people think?
Márquez is my favourite, but I reread a couple of Márquez's novels recently, and I think I find them rather dated now.
I have to say, I don't find him dated. I mean, I haven't read 100 Years of Solitude for a long time, but... The General and His Labyrinth I reread recently, and News of a Kidnapping, one of his non-fiction books, and I just thought they were magnificent. I mean, I think, you know, he's a really great world writer who I feel has stood up to the passage of the decades.
Yeah, I'm reading Love in the Time of Cholera again. And, yeah, the sheer quality of the writing is the thing that really hits you.
Yeah, I think he's just magnificent. I really do.
I've been reading quite a lot of Barbara Commons recently, and I've just finished Who Was Changed and Who Was Dead, and you can kind of see magical realism seeping into those kind of very, not kitchen sink kind of dramas, but, you know, that kind of everyday comedy of manners or what have you, but then with these very dark influences or kind of supernatural elements and quite violent episodes.
I haven't read Commons myself, and I mentioned her in passing in my book about Angela Carter, and I described her as a precursor to Angela Carter, which is how I'd seen her described elsewhere, and I received a lot of angry letters to do with that sentence, saying, how dare you condescend to the magnificent Barbara Commons. So she is on my reading list.
Well, that's you told.
Yeah.
Gail, I'm going to drag you in here neck and crop because you've been noticeably silent.
I've now, been keeping my head down, absolutely.
I know you're not a huge fan of magical realism. Have you read any of it?
Well, I've read 100 Years of Solitude and Love in the Time of Cholera. In fact, I actually read them on a trek in South America. But I'm curious to know what, you know, towards the end of Angela Carter's life, because she died, you know, very young, didn't she?
She did. She died aged 51 in 1992. So after Carter returned to England from Japan in 1974, she had, by writing these books like The Infernal Desire Machines of Dr. Hoffman, basically alienated her former readership and torpedoed her reputation as an up-and-coming young writer, and entered into what she described as her years of obscurity. She moved to Bath, where she met the man who would become her second husband, Mark Pierce, who was 14 years younger than her and was a construction worker. She met him when he was building an extension on the house opposite hers. And she entered a period of sort of domestic stability and happiness with him. and they had a child. But her literary production slowed right down, and although she wrote some of her most famous novels then, including Nights at the Circus and Wise Children, her last two novels, she increased her production of non-fiction writing during this time, it should be said. She wrote a marvellous book-length essay called The Sardian Woman, the rather quixotic project of reclaiming the Marquis de Sade as an ally of feminism.
We all need to read that.
Yeah. She was diagnosed with lung cancer and died in February 1992. And so her productivity was cut short, just as she was in her prime as a writer, really.
It's a sad loss, isn't it? Because you do wonder where she would have gone after that, because she certainly was a woman who was an agile writer, wasn't she? A woman with many ideas in her head and not wedded to a particular genre, really, in any way.
No, absolutely. And I think it's impossible to know really where she would have gone. I think the only certainty is that she would have continued to surprise us.
Yeah.
I mean, I regret really the loss of the journalism, apart from anything that she might have written, because I think that she was, as well as being a magnificent novelist, probably the greatest English journalist since Orwell. I mean, I think her reportage, her reviews, her sort of opinion pieces are just tremendous. They're so funny, they're so lively, they're so intelligent and well-informed. And just as a cultural commentator, I think she's pretty much unparalleled. And to hear what she would have had to say about, you know, New Labour, Donald Trump, Brexit, all of this, I just think it's a huge loss.
Because I was going to ask you, actually, you know, for people not familiar with her work, where would you suggest they start?
I would suggest with the two collections, actually, the collection of journalism, Shaking a Leg, and the collected stories, which is called Burning Your Boats. And I think those are the best places to start, because you get her fiction, her wildness in capsule form, and her intelligence and kind of anger.
Steph, what about magical realism? Where should people start?
Well, with Angela Carter, I would say The Bloody Chamber, because it's just such an extraordinary work. Maybe Gail should read it.
There's no pressure here. Yeah.
And for other authors, I loved Isabel Allende, her collection of stories and her novels, and I read those alongside Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I think my favourite of his would be Love in the Time of Cholera. That's a beautiful book and a great love story.
Edmund, thank you. It's been a very interesting ride through Angela Carter and the lesser slopes of magical realism. I'm hoping that we'll get Gail on board at some stage, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
Will you stay with us and come up with a book recommendation for us?
Yes, absolutely. Sure.
Thank you. Before we move on, a brief word about Slightly Foxed. Elegant, eclectic and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Now, Anna, you've got another of your Book Lovers Day trips for us. Full disclosure for listeners overseas, and we do know that, you know, more than half of you are listening to this outside the UK. We have mostly stuck to UK destinations so far, though we did venture as far as Rome. But we will look at destinations beyond our own shores in due course. And if you have a suggestion, please do drop Anna a line through the website. But today, Anna, what have you got for us?
So yes, we are staying a little closer to home, Keats House. It's in Hampstead, London, and it was built actually just a couple of years before Keats went to stay there, originally two separate homes, And then in 1818, Keats went to stay there, and he lived there for 17 months before he travelled to Italy, where he died. So this is where he was, where he was really quite ill. But while he was here, it was a fruitful time. He composed La Belle Dame sans Merci, finished The Eve of St. Agnes, and wrote his Odes of Spring in 1819, including Ode to a Nightingale. And then Charles went with Dilke, who lived on the other side of the house. They left for more central London, and Fanny Braun's family moved in and became their neighbours. So Fanny Braun, the love of his life, who he intended to marry and wrote a great many letters to and about. And yes, so now the house is a museum, and it displays books, letters, paintings. Among them is a copy of Keats' death mask and also the engagement ring that he gave Fanny Braun, amongst all sorts of other artefacts from his life. And it's mostly just kept as it was.
Because it's not a posh house, is it, Anna?
No, it's not. And it's not very large. And I think you kind of feel that it really was a home. Yes, you've got information boards on the wall. But apart from that, you know, it could just be your living room and, you know, with a library and...
Well, I mean, it's a great part of London, isn't it? Because, I mean, Hampstead's like a literary who's who anyway. And that, where the house is a particularly gorgeous bit of Hampstead, isn't it? And just off the edge of the heath.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it makes for a perfect day out where you can go for a long walk on the heath and just wander the streets there, which are relatively unchanged. It does very much feel like you're kind of going back in time.
Thank you, Anna. Book recommendations from everyone, please. Steph, can I start with you?
Yes, I want to be a bit cheeky and recommend two books today.
Okay.
One is Edmund Gordon's The Invention of Angela Carter.
Thank you.
It's an amazing biography. Absolutely everything you would want to know about Angela. And alongside that, I want to recommend Susanna Clapp's A Card from Angela Carter. Anna and I went to see Edmund and Susanna talk. They did a two-hander. And it really brought Angela Carter alive. Susanna Clapp is her literary executor and first met Angela Carter when she commissioned her to write for the London Review of Books. It's a very short book, and it is based around the postcards that Angela sent to Susanna. And she's written little memories to accompany each postcard. Together, they just build a fantastic picture of this woman, and I'd recommend them alongside each other.
Thank you. Edmund.
Thank you. Well, I've been reading quite a lot by Jean author Thomas Bernhard recently. Faber re-released most of his novels in 2019, and I just picked one up a couple of months ago, and I've been quite addicted to them ever since. The most recent one that I read is Extinction, but they're all of a piece with one another. They all feature a deeply disaffected first-person narrator who, in kind of unparagraphed prose, just embarks on this blackly comic aria in which he just lays into everything from himself to Austrian society to... And they're among the funniest books I think I've ever read.
Written when, Edmund?
Written between the 1950s and the 1980s.
Okay.
Extinction was his last novel, and I think probably his greatest. The narrator tends not to do very much, so it begins with the narrator receiving news that his parents and brother have died, and that he therefore has inherited this grand house, which he never expected to do. And he then spends the next 150 pages just thinking about the house. And it's this kind of sense of a mind totally eating itself almost. And then 150 pages in, he returns to the house, and there's a little bit of action towards the end of the novel. But I think they're terrific. They're unlike anything I've read before.
Oh, that's great. Anna?
I am going to recommend Station 11 by Emily St. John Mundell. This was published in 2014, but does seem particularly prescient now. It's about a travelling Shakespearean theatre company in North America after a virus known as the Georgian flu has devastated the population. And it is not the kind of thing that I would usually choose to read, but was completely gripping, very well written. It begins at a production of King Lear in Toronto. The actor named Arthur playing Lear, he dies on stage. And then we pick up 20 years later after the flu's devastation and follow a woman named Kirsten, who was a child actress in the production. She's now in a troupe of actors called the Travelling Symphony, who perform Shakespeare plays to depleted population. And she has a set of graphic novels given to her by Arthur before his death, called Dr. Eleven. Unknown to her, this graphic novel is an unpublished project by Arthur's first wife, Miranda. And so you get all of these different characters and many more, and much more about the lives they led and lead, switching between the past and the present continuously, with more and more revelations about the connections and the echoes and links between them all. And it converges at an airport. We learn that a flight has been grounded at the Severn City Airport due to the pandemic, and the passengers created a settlement in the airport and curate this museum of civilization, which has phone items like iPhones and laptops. So it's lots of very interesting ideas, and it sounds like it could be very bleak, but it's really not. It's full of life. It's a celebration of life and what people create and how people survive, and it's just a great adventure story, I would say.
Thank you, Anna. Gail, what have you got for us?
Well, I've just finished reading the most fascinating book, which has a sort of revelation on virtually every page. It's by Ferdinand Mount. It's called Kiss Myself Goodbye, and the subtitle is The Many Lives of Aunt Munker, and it was published last year. Ferdinand Mount had this aunt who he and his sister used to go and visit and stay with, and she was his godmother. She would take him to the Café de Paris, she'd take him to Claridge's, and she had a daughter called Georgie, an adored only child, who was swamped by Aunt Munker's affection and attention, and actually went off the rails very badly subsequently. And Ferdinand Mount, he must be in his late 60s now, he's obviously going back to his childhood, and he starts to question his memories of his aunt. At one point he remembers that the aunt adopts another little girl called Celeste, and she's there for a couple of summers, and then she's unadopted. And it subsequently becomes clear that actually Georgie is not Aunt Munker's daughter. She's adopted. And then there's Aunt Munker has a brother called Buster, and it turns out that Buster is actually Aunt Munker's son. Mm. And he gradually begins to unravel this, the most extraordinary story. I can't tell you how many revelations there are, but it's basically about a generation who reinvented themselves, who lied and created deceptions because of the conventions of the time. And yes, I think probably every family's got, you know, skeletons in the cupboard. I mean, Ferdinand Mount has got an entire emporium of skeletons in the cupboard. And it reminded me of my own family, where after elderly relatives' deaths, it became clear that somebody had a child who was adopted that none of us knew about. Another man had a mistress. I mean, actually, I'm going to have to reread it because it's just breathtaking in the something like 15 marriages involved, lots of divorces, and then the most astonishing revelation right at the very end of the book.
What was the name again, Kate?
It's called Kiss Myself Goodbye by Ferdinand Mount.
Thank you. That is about it for this month, and many thanks, Edmund.
Thank you.
We'll be back next month. Dig into the show notes if you'd like to be reminded of any of the writers and the books we've mentioned in this episode. Please do take a moment to rate us on your podcast app if you can spare the time. I know not all the apps will let you do that, but Apple certainly does if you feel inclined. Until next month, thanks for listening and for joining us on another literary trek off the beaten track.